Welcome to ACLU Studio, the podcast series for those who just can't get enough of the ACLU. In this episode, ACLU Deputy Legal Director Jamil Jaffer talks with former FBI Special Agent Ali Soufan about his new book, The Black Banners, the inside story of 9/11 and the war against Al-Qaeda.
Ali Soufan, thanks for joining us on ACLU Studio.
Jamil, thank you for having me.
So, Ali, your book is called The Black Banners, the inside story of 9/11 and the war against Al-Qaeda. Among other things, it's an account of your almost 10 years as an FBI special agent investigating and interrogating suspected terrorists. So let me start by asking you why you wrote the book.
Well, there's a lot of false narratives about the war on terror and about Al-Qaeda. For example, when it comes to 9/11, a lot of people still believe we did not know what hit us on 9/11. We had no idea about that threat that called Al-Qaeda. Not a lot of people know that we actually indicted Osama bin Laden in a sealed indictment in the Southern District of New York in June of 1998, a few months even before the very first covert act that Al-Qaeda conducted, which is the East Africa embassy bombings. When it comes to the alleged successes or failures after 9/11, a lot of people still have problem knowing the reality of what actually happened. There's a lot of false narratives, for example, about the alleged efficacy of enhanced interrogation techniques. And I show in the book that everything you've been told about enhanced interrogation techniques, about the successes of enhanced interrogation techniques, about the alleged plots that were disrupted because of enhanced interrogation techniques, we actually didn't know about it way before enhanced interrogation techniques was even a policy or were even applied.
So let me ask you about interrogation. So one of the things you write in your book, this quote from your book, an interrogation is a mind game in which you have to use your wits and knowledge of the detainee to convince or steer him to cooperate. So what does that approach look like in practice?
In practice is an approach that based on two things, based on knowledge of the detainee, of the subject matter, of the network that you're investigating, and based of empathy. In understanding, trying to find an understanding with the detainee, at least on a human level. And that is a technique that has been utilized by law enforcement and even in the United States by intelligence agencies for the longest time. We have been operating for many, many years, many, many decades. In my experience in the FBI, I was involved in so many high-value operations, you know, and I learned from some of the best in the business, not only FBI agents, but also from the Department of Defense, from CIA, from NYPD. And I learned how to interact with the detainees. And you know, what you see in Hollywood, what you see in 24, is not the reality of what happened. And a lot of people tell me, well, we saw it on 24. You know, you rough the guy a little bit and he talks.
Let me ask you about this, because obviously it's not just 24. It's, you know, after 9/11, the CIA started using these much more aggressive interrogation methods, in some cases used torture. And, you know, that wasn't the decision of low-level CIA agents. It was a decision made at the very top, and not just at the CIA, but a decision made at the White House to authorize those methods. So why is it that the two agencies, at the FBI and the CIA, went in such different directions?
Well, you know what? From my personal experience, when I saw firsthand, when they started applying these kind of techniques, many CIA officers protested. As I say in the book, one CIA officer actually left even before I left the location where Abu Zubaydah was, and I testified about that in the Senate. That shows that there was conflicting positions inside the CIA. One position, which is basically bureaucrats, politically appointed individuals who wanted to satisfy the political establishment at the time in DC. And the professionals and the practitioners are saying, no, we shouldn't be doing that. That will have a lot of harm on the CIA and on the United States reputation in the short term and in the long term. And I saw that firsthand, what was happening at the time. And many CIA officers actually continue to complain over the years about enhanced interrogation techniques, not necessarily about the CIA program as a whole, but about that small element of it that includes enhanced interrogation techniques and waterboarding. And towards the end, there was an investigation by the CIA Inspector General. And I think you did a lot of work to be sure that this investigation, or the results, the findings of this investigation, was disclosed to the public and declassified.
Right, we did some litigation under the Freedom of Exactly. Information Act.
And you see the Inspector General of the CIA basically saying that they cannot confirm one single imminent attack was stopped because of enhanced interrogation techniques.
So how do you feel when you see, for example, former Vice President Cheney saying on national TV that this program, the CIA program, was effective? What's your reaction to that?
Well, look, the CIA program in general had a lot of good things because it was the only program for detainees for the longest period of time. Enhanced interrogation techniques, waterboarding, specifically what Vice President Cheney talks about, former Vice President Cheney talks about, I think he has a lot of problems with the efficacy and with the accuracy of that statement. Because we were told what we produced from waterboarding. We were told we were able to identify Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as a mastermind of 9/11. We were told we were able to identify Jose Padilla as a possible dirty bomber, quote unquote. We were told that there was problems and there is a threat that we disrupted in blowing up apartment buildings in the United States or attacking the Brooklyn Bridge. So if you look at all these alleged plots that we were told that resulted because of enhanced interrogation techniques, I have a big problem with that because I was there. We knew about all these plots between April and between May of 2001. Waterboarding did not start until August of 2002. So there is a problem with the timeline. Mr. Right. Padilla was arrested in the United States in May of 2002. Waterboarding did not start until August of 2002.
Now, in your book, you talk actually, it's not just that the information that that the CIA is said to have got was actually got before the waterboarding was used. It's also that some of the information that was obtained through the use of enhanced interrogation methods was actually inaccurate. And you give this story about Alibi.
The story of Alibi shows the tragic consequences of depending on these kind of techniques. There's a big difference between compliance and cooperation. Enhanced interrogation techniques, waterboarding, and other similar techniques can get the detainee to be compliant with you. But compliance and cooperation are two different things. And I talk in the book about many incidences where we saved lives, we get actionable intelligence, we get some of the best intelligence in the war on terrorism, but we did it by the book, and we were able to get cooperation, and we were able to do the job keeping the end game in mind. You know, we're a democracy. Towards the end, we're not going to put a bullet in the head of some person and bury him under a tree. We have to prosecute them. And most of the people that we are getting information from, and the examples that I put in the book, are people who we were able to prosecute, and we actually effectively prosecuted them. The case of Ibn Sheikh Alibi is just a perfect example of the problems of compliance versus cooperation. There is an individual who, after was tortured, admitted that Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein are working together in developing a WMD. That was a huge success for a lot of people in Washington. Because at the time, imagine me or somebody in the FBI or somebody in the CIA saying torture doesn't work, and then they have the information that they needed that Saddam and Al-Qaeda are working together on WMD.
President Bush used that information in a national speech.
And Colin Powell used it in the UN, right. Specifically naming Ibn Sheikh Alibi. After we went to Iraq, after we found out that Al-Qaeda and Saddam were not working together, after we found out that there is no WMD program for Al-Qaeda, nor, you know, there is a coordination regarding WMD training with the Iraqis, they went back to Ibn Sheikh Alibi and said, hey, what did you lie? He said, well, you know, to paraphrase what he said, I was being tortured. I gave you what you wanted to hear. And look at the consequences of this. Look at the tragic results of going to war in Iraq. of establishing an international coalition based on that statement to help us to invade another country. And look at the hundreds of thousands of people who were killed because of that. Look at how it affected the United States policy, not only in the region of the Middle East, but also in the world. Look how that affected and helped actually Al-Qaeda recruit individuals. It gave Al-Qaeda another life. After 9/11, Al-Qaeda were a dead breed. So this just shows a perfect example how compliance and cooperation, two different things, and how, yes, you will get the information that you need. You will be happy with that information, but is it an accurate information? Is it the truth? This is a big question here.
Your book had to go through a review process by the FBI and the CIA.
Interesting thing. I mean, I am an FBI agent, former FBI agent. I worked with the Bureau. I have an NDA with the FBI, non-disclosure agreements with the FBI. And I was going to send the FBI my book anyway, even if I don't have NDA. I left the government in 2005. I don't want to mention anything in the book that can harm national security or ongoing operations. So I sent the book to the FBI, and after about 3 months, the FBI approved the book as is. We did not
have one single redaction.
No,
and,
we did
and
not
yet
have
there any. Are all these redactions in your book.
Well, the problem is, and that's something I still don't understand until now, how can I go through the double jeopardy of pre-publication reviews? I mean, now my book has to go through the CIA, and they had to do a pre-publication review, their own pre-publication review in this matter. And that review did not go as good as the one by the FBI.
So all the redactions that are in the book now are traceable not to the FBI, but to the CIA.
Yes, so the FBI said they are okay, the CIA said. Now, I understand that the FBI needs to send some information that they believe it's CIA information. CIA have originator control authority over this information, and the FBI does not know if the information is public or not public or has been declassified or not declassified. I respect that. But that should have been done when the FBI was doing their own review. It cannot be done after, and it cannot be done by the CIA having authority over the entire manuscript. I mean, this is where the problem is. But, we're still working through these kind of things, especially that a lot of readers, and I'm sure you read the book and you saw that some of these redactions are simply silly. I mean, my statement to the Senate that is posted on the Senate.gov, how can you say that statement is
right? Classified? I think a lot of the information that's been redacted is plainly already in the public domain. I mean,
exactly.
It's obvious to anyone who knows,
right.
Who knows anything.
Not only in
the
public domain
subject,
that they were published in the Washington Post or New York Times.
But
in the public
by the
domain,
government.
In the
right.
public domain, that means they have been, when I say public domain, and I'm sure you mean the same thing, has been declassified by the U.S. government. I mean, there was a lawsuit that you did about the destruction of the tapes.
Right.
And there's a lot of the emails from the lawsuit that is, CIA emails that's posted on your website.
Sure.
Now, I used one of these emails, and I said it's a declassified email. And they redacted that, even though anyone can go to, your website and find that email. Or a paragraph from the 9/11 Commission report. How can a paragraph from the 9/11 Commission report, that, by the way, was used also in Tennant's book, be considered that, and Mr. Tennant's book has been through the CIA pre-publication review, can be considered declassified.
So this is actually an interesting point for our listeners, I think. So the same information that the CIA allowed George Tennant to publish, they have restricted you from publishing.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And the idea was, from what we understood it, is a narrative. The narrative that Mr. Tennant talked about in his book is very different than the narrative that I'm saying. So they are actually looking into, doing an oversight of a narrative, which is in total violation. I don't know much about these issues, but from what I understand, it's in total violation of the executive order.
Right. I mean, it's also viewpoint discrimination that's unconstitutional.
Absolutely.
Under the First Amendment. I mean, the you're too nice to say it this way, but the CIA doesn't like the conclusions that you're drawing from the same facts that George Tenet recited in his book. George Tenet draws one set of conclusions, and you draw another set of conclusions.
Well, one of the things that makes me really satisfied the support that I got from so many CIA officers, even CIA officers who are still in. And remember, the people who stopped that program, enhanced interrogation, were actually CIA. It's not DOJ. Right. It is not DOD. It's not General Petraeus, when he was in Iraq and saw the negative effects of Abu Ghraib on the insurgency and so forth. It is basically CIA officers who said, we shouldn't be doing this. We put our life on the line every day to protect this nation and to protect the Constitution. And these people are really great people. That's why, I talk about them a lot in my book. Many of the heroes in the book are CIA officers. Right, a senior CIA officer in Guantanamo. He was a hero in a lot of ways when we were working in Guantanamo together. Or the CIA officer who said, I'm going to try to stop this rendition thing because we shouldn't be doing these kind of things. And, in a way, we're like conspiring together, FBI CIA in the field, that hopefully we can keep Washington at bay. So this is not an issue of FBI versus CIA. It's an issue of a lot of good people in FBI, in the CIA, in the Department of Defense. These people who I know firsthand, I worked with them firsthand. They put their life on the line for the country and for what we believe in. And versus Washington, and you see that clearly in the book. And it was very satisfying for me that so many colleagues from the CIA, sent messages of support. And
I'm glad to hear that.
On the jacket, there's a CIA officer, Bob Baer, who said, "Superb an education and the best book on Al Qaeda out there, bar none."
We're running out of time, but I want to ask you one more question about. Just to satisfy my own curiosity, so I'm curious to know how much you knew on you were on the front lines here. How much did you know about the debates that were taking place in the White House and at the high levels of the Justice Department? When did you first see the torture memos? When did you first see the you and Bradbury memos?
Well, we start hearing about debate that was going on that. Possibly we're going down the wrong path as early as mid-April of 2002. The reason we had that is because they sent outside contractors to do the job. And many of the CIA guys on the ground, and I was with another FBI agent, we were fighting back and saying, look, you know what? We don't do these kind of things. So people on the ground started to ask for legal guidance. And at the beginning, we got the legal guidance from the White House. And, I remember looking at it, it's like, wait a second, this is not a Department of Justice guideline. A lawyer for somebody in the White House does not give me an authority as an FBI agent or as a CIA officer to do what you're asking us to do. And then that resulted into meetings and verbal approval. And all these things were happening in, mid-April, April, May, that time period. Right. So this is when, but how, what
but level? But when the memo came, when the memo was issued in August of 2002, the techniques memo, did you see it at that time?
No. I left in May 25th. I left the location on May 25th because I thought we were going down on a path that's not going to lead us. There's nothing good that can come out of this. So I reported it to the Bureau, and to his credit, the FBI director said, we don't do that. And eventually the FBI were pulled.
Same thing happened at Guantanamo.
From all these locations. Right. And at the time, that's it. There was a wall. The program was kind of like a program into itself. Not a lot of people had access to the information.
So did you see the memos before they were made public?
No.
Ali Soufan, thanks again for joining us on ACLU Studio.
Thank you, Jamil. Thank you for having me.
Be sure to tune in to the next ACLU Studio podcast when ACLU National Security Project Litigation Director Ben Wisner talks with Harvard historian Jonathan Hansen about his new book, Guantanamo, An American History.